Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. Michelle Perkins is back yet again after kind of a little bit of a hiatus. I feel like we're just having you right back. We missed you so much, we want you back again. We're talking about fever phobia this time. And before we get too far into this, Michelle, will you just reintroduce yourself yet again?
Okay, well, thanks so much again for having me on here. This has been a lot of fun. You picked some great topics, some great papers to go over. So it's really a lot of fun for me. I am Michelle Perkins. I am an emergency doc in Down East Maine, working a rural critical access hospital.
Michelle, it's worth kind of mentioning, and I didn't really know this until we started talking more, especially with the last podcast where we're talking about vaginal bleeding and ultrasound, but you used to work family practice as well.
Yeah, that was my primary. It was always moonlighting in the ED as I was doing it to kind of keep my hand in, but I was in practice for quite some time. So I've been on both ends of this particular topic we're going to be talking about. And so I have an appreciation for both sides, to be sure.
Now, there's no shame in this, Michelle, but when you were back in family practice, did you have fever phobia?
I tried not to, but I felt like a salmon swimming upstream.
And so let's go ahead and we'll jump right into this. It's worth noting, because the way this podcast is going to be set up, there's probably going to be people who are patients, parents of patients, and of course, you know, those who are actually providing the care for these patients, all listening to this podcast, because this is something that they're going to find, they're going to look at, they're going to want to know more about. So it's worth just having this little disclaimer at the beginning that you always need to use your own best clinical judgment. Or if you're parents, I mean, if your kid looks sick, you're worried about them, this doesn't mean that you shouldn't do anything with them or that you shouldn't worry about their fever. But again, fever is just a number. This is just one part of the illness itself. So don't look at a fever and freak out just by fever alone. If that's all you're worried about, there probably isn't something to be as concerned with. But if your kid looks sick, looks horribly sick, has this fever, has other things you're worried about, then bring them in. But that's, I think, the ultimate point of this. If we can just, you know, basically go home after this point, is just the fever as a number doesn't matter by itself, but it's all about how your kid or the patient or whoever's in front of you looks.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to look at the kid and not look at the number. Although it's scary as a parent, or even as a provider, you see a kid with a really high temp, there's this automatic gut level reaction because we have the fever phobia kind of rammed down our throats. And it's a very real thing, not just with parents and patients, but among clinicians. It happens, I'm sure it happens to you every shift, where you see people sent in because they have a fever by their primary care, or their primary care has told them that if the fever persists for more than a day or so, then you absolutely need to be rechecked because something serious is going on. So it's not just the lay community that buys into these myths that we're going to be talking about. It's healthcare professionals as well.
Absolutely. And another little disclaimer here is that when we're talking about fever, we're pretty much addressing people over 3 months of age. And I feel like that's another important caveat, because under 3 months, especially when we're talking about neonates, that fever could be a harbinger of something much more serious. So again, if you're talking about a fever in a little kiddo, this is again a different subject altogether, because they're at higher risk for sepsis or meningitis or other things that, especially in a neonate, you can have a normal looking kid, because they all look normal at that point until they're super sick. So don't just rely on this kind of information for the really young ones. This is more designed for those that are old enough where we can look and say this kid is sick, or we're not worried about. And again, this is actually, again, worth emphasizing, immunized children, since I seem to see a lot of those unimmunized children, even though I don't live in the states where it's really popular. I just feel like as of late, I've been finding more and more non-immunized kids. But that's another little important caveat. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I was going to chime in with the same thing. You know, the other patient population that we have to treat differently and not use this as a one size fits all. If you get a kid that's immunocompromised for one reason or another, has underlying illness of whatever kind, chronic illness, we obviously will take the fevers more seriously in them, simply because it's generally, it could be a harbinger of something really bad going on. So,
all right. So I think we've got all of our little disclaimers out of the way, unless we can think of something else. But one other little thing that, Michelle, you mentioned, and it's something that was so natural to me, I didn't even think about it, but we still treat fevers when these kids come in, and there are different mindsets. If you ask our nurses, it's because we're treating that dirty little number and bringing it down. But a lot of times these kids come in with slightly abnormal vital signs, the most common thing being tachycardia. And Michelle, why don't you explain about why we do that and what the purpose is for that?
Yeah, it used to make me nuts when the nurses would jump all over the kid in triage and, can I give him Tylenol? Can I give him ibuprofen? Because I really felt that we were feeding right into this phobia. Well, if the nurses in the ED treat this, then it must be something that I need to be treating at home. But it actually does help us in our role as clinicians to try to evaluate what's going on with them. Because if you get a kid with a fever and tachycardia, is he tachycardic because he's febrile or is he tachycardic because he's really sick? So if you bring that temperature down and he's still tachycardic, then you really do have to worry a little bit more that, you know, is this dehydration? Is this pre-shock? Is this some other bad process going on? So that's one reason to do it. And also, these kids, when you have a fever, they look sick. They look like they feel awful. And sometimes if you can get the fever down and you go in and they're running around pulling things off the wall, it's actually a lot more reassuring than if you get the fever down and they still are limp and listless. So there is a role for treating the fever in the emergency department, at least from a diagnostic standpoint, I think.
And you mentioned it right there. We're going to kind of hit this a little bit more in our quote-unquote myths section, is that the kid, I think it's always kind of complex. Are they looking like crap because it's their fever, or is it just because their illness in general? But for whatever reason, I mean, no matter what, if they look crappy, you give them some medicine, it seems to do better. They're doing great, and they're in a much better spot than they were previously. So either way, I feel like this is kind of the main thing to address. But I think we're almost sneaking ahead into our next section. So I didn't have a better name for this. And when I was trying to look up material on the podcast, you know, fever phobia and myths of fever seem to be the common themes. So I went ahead and just outlined some common myths that we're going to hear about or see or talk with patients or even other healthcare providers. Because again, everyone kind of makes these mistakes. And this is a lot of things we're taught in school, but not necessarily true. So you ready to dive into some of these myths here, Michelle?
Sounds great.
All right. So let's go with, I guess, myth number one, probably one of the most common ones. My child's warm, so the kid has to have a fever.
Yeah, and that's not always the case. I mean, if the kid's been running around, the kid's been outside, the kid's been crying, it could be warm for a whole bunch of different reasons that have nothing to do with a fever.
It's worth kind of noting, you have to keep in mind that core body temperatures are going to be the most reliable, especially rectal temperatures at young ages. And it's actually worth kind of noting at this point, too. There was a study, and I forgot to add this, and I'll try and add it in the show notes. But even in adults, like geriatric patients, don't use a normal temperature as a rule out alone if you're highly suspecting infection for, like, oh, we got an axillary and oral temp. Because when they're septic, they can actually have a low or normal temperature more peripherally. But when you get that rectal or Foley temp, it's like 101, 102 or higher than that. So if you're worried about sepsis or you're worried about serious infection in the geriatric or in the pediatric patient or just in general, but especially in those age groups because they seem to be the big ones, if you don't believe the number and you can't rule it in with a peripheral temperature, use your core temperatures to help get that better number.
Absolutely, because if they're clamped down peripherally, you're not getting an accurate peripheral temperature at all.
All right, so let's kind of jump into the next myth here. What's an actual low-grade fever, Michelle?
Ask a patient, you'll get a different answer than the actual answer. I usually run 98, so 99 is a fever for me. Hear that all day long. But in any case, an actual low-grade fever is anything above 100, so it's 100 to 102 degrees, or 37.8 to 39 degrees Celsius.
Yes, if you're basically not American, you'll know your Celsius versus your Fahrenheit. But we hear all the time that, well, they had a 98.7. I love when I hear parents who say, well, they have a 98 temperature, they have a fever. Well, little Johnny usually runs at 97. That's still okay.
No, I mean, temperature's up and down all day long. Everybody, there's no such thing as it's normal for me temperature. Fever is a fever.
And this happens most when they go to bed. I love when parents are like, well, they feel warm. They had a temperature of 99 or, you know, just something kind of borderline-ish and not even actually where we consider fever, which is, you know, 38 degrees or higher Celsius or 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit. And the main reason is because at night, temperature can increase for a little bit and they'll drop back down again. But just during throughout the day, like you said, with activity or stuff like that, these can all cause these quote-unquote low-grade fevers that parents talk about, but not the quote-unquote low-grade fevers we're talking about.
Yeah, that's an important distinction.
All right, so next common myth, if there's a fever, it has to be bad for the patient.
Well, actually, no, fever is actually our friend. Fever is your body's doing what it's supposed to do. It's fighting an infection. The temps are actually helping with your body fighting the infection. The fever is actually helping your immune system, helping your body fight off whatever you're fighting off. So there's no real reason to treat it if the fever isn't actually bothering the patient. If the patient is uncomfortable, though, you know how you feel when you have a fever. It's kind of uncomfortable. If the patient is uncomfortable, then it's perfectly reasonable to treat the fever. But treating it just for the absolute number in and of itself is really not a good way to go.
Now, I'm a guy, so if I get like a temp of 100, I feel like I'm going to die. That's the whole man flu thing. Remember that?
Very important to make that distinction as well.
All right. So just as Michelle mentioned, it's worth noting that most fevers are really trying to help. It's only when we get really, really high in our temperatures that we need to start talking about it. And we'll discuss that more here in a minute. But most people will generally agree that a temperature between 100 and 104 is pretty beneficial as far as what it's doing. Now, if the patient looks like crap or whatever, then you can give some medicines. And that's where I'm giving medicine for patient comfort. It's not because of the temperature. And some people who are listening to this may freak out. And I tell this to parents all the time. Like, I do this with my kids too. Now, given I have a little bitty baby, so as we talked about, little disclaimer at the beginning, that's a whole different boat. But when we're talking about my older child, when she had a couple of cases of UTI, and then most recently she had pneumonia, when we saw her temperature, there were times where she was 103 and just running around and having a great time, and she looked great. Did I treat it? No, I'm letting the body do its thing. But when she had a temperature of 101, but she's laying on the couch, you know, acting like she's in total misery, yeah, I'll treat that. Not the fever, again, the symptoms themselves. So that's a big difference.
Right. And also, fever can cause dehydration. So if that's a concern with your patient or your kid, for that matter, then that's another indication to treat it.
All right, moving on to the next myth. If we treat the fever, the patient will be sicker and for a longer period of time.
Well, that's not really supported by current evidence. Current evidence is that it doesn't change the duration of symptoms or the febrile illness. So basically, if you treat it for the patient's comfort, you're not going to make them sick longer.
I'm going to plug the SGM here because I was just on the SGM not that long ago again, that they did a wonderful review on this a few years back, and they included the study that we're using in the show notes. And by the way, for those of you listening who don't check out the show notes have all the sources we're citing for this, because about every single point we're going through has citations with it. So we're not just pulling this out of our collective butts here. Speaking of, let's move on to the next thing here. A temperature over 104, or again, 40 degrees Celsius is bad, right? And could cause brain damage, Michelle.
Oh, no. But, you know, this is this number of 104 came from studies that were looking at hyperthermia damage and not necessarily temperatures that high from a fever. I mean, the fever is your body's physiologic response. So it's very, very uncommon for you to get a temp over 104. And even then, what we see from the literature, again, looking at hyperthermia, is that temperatures above 108 are what cause brain damage. And you physiologically are not going to get there with just a fever. Now, when you see temps that high, it's because there's some sort of non-infectious cause going on, such as certain drugs, you know, malignant hyperthermia or hot environments, like you leave the kid in the car. That's a whole different ballgame than what your body actually is doing to mount a response to infection.
Yeah, and this 108 degree Fahrenheit or 42 Celsius, that number is probably the closest thing to a realistic number we can get. But even after looking at some studies, it's kind of interesting because even a lot of them will do okay. But this 104 number, this 40 degrees Celsius that's get pulled out for the brain damage thing, again, this is based on really, really weak evidence. And this actually dealt more with meningitis pre-vaccination era where we were just using these numbers as like, hey, a lot of these kids had meningitis, so it's kind of which one came first. But then there's been follow-up studies like with athletes, and athletes have had temperatures measured over 104 or 40 degrees Celsius and had no issues, no harm after doing that athletic event. So again, people who are healthy with these temperatures, it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's what's going on underlying. And as Michelle mentioned, there's this beautiful thing called the hypothalamus, and that's what's regulating our body temperature. And most of the time, it's going to prevent us from getting over that 104 mark. And we're going to talk about that here a little more in just a second. But just keep in mind, the body has its own mechanisms of keeping things in place.
Right. I mean, the hypothalamus does a very good job of controlling that physiologic response. It's when you have the exogenous hyperthermia that you can get your body that hot, but not generally internally.
And again, one of those being brain damage itself. So sometimes with head bleeds, because that can potentially mess with the hypothalamus. Or the other thing is the extremely hot environment, like you left your kid in a car. All right, and let's move on to the next myth. So a high fever will cause a seizure, and that is, of course, bad.
Well, it's bad and scary from a parent standpoint. There is more thinking now that, I mean, it's not something you run into all the time, but it's relatively common, I would say. But they're thinking now that it's not the fever that's causing the seizure, but actually whatever's infectious process is going on that causes the seizure. Because the absolute number of a fever is not really an indicator as to whether or not a kid will have a seizure. You can see seizures at 100 degrees, you can see at 104. So it's not really an indicator of whether or not a kid is going to have a seizure. And if it does occur, it's usually benign, although again, it's terrifying. But you know, looking at the recurrence with these, one third of kids that have a febrile seizure will recur. There are things that can predispose you for recurrent seizures, but again, the fever is not one of those things. I mean, there's this, again, this myth out there. I'll see parents all the time say, well, she had a febrile seizure when she was three. So her doc says, anytime she gets sick, I absolutely have to keep her temperature normal. So they give them, you know, antipyretics of one form or another around the clock every time they're sick. And that's just really not the case. Reducing the fever does not necessarily reduce the incidence of recurrence. And in any case, these aren't damaging to the kids. I mean, they don't cause anything permanent. It's only a third of the time they're going to have another one.
Michelle, you've been practicing for a very long time. Have you seen the normothermic, I shouldn't really call it normothermic, but again, maybe temperature's a little elevated, but not quite a true fever because parents have been treating it and then the kid still has a seizure?
Yeah, actually that is happening. And again, I think it's one of the reasons why the thought is that it's not necessarily the fever, the number that is causing the seizure, but actually whatever underlying illness that is causing the kid to be febrile in the first place is what's causing the seizure. There are a whole host of things, you know, that they've looked at, what kids are more susceptible to febrile seizures. And it's, you know, family history, that type of thing. But it's, again, not the fever in and of itself generally that causes it in the first place.
And we'll include, again, this information in the show notes, because otherwise it gets really technical really quickly about how this works. But basically, it's an inflammatory cascade that may actually be the real cause for febrile seizures. So febrile seizures may be more or less a misnomer to what is actually going on. All right, next point. Well, you should have to treat the fever then to prevent febrile seizures. I know we kind of talked about this, but let's actually talk about some of the evidence behind this.
Yeah, the evidence doesn't really show that treating the fevers makes a difference. It doesn't reduce the incidence of them actually happening or in the incidence of them recurrence when a kid has actually had a febrile seizure in the past.
And if you're interested more in specifically this information, again, we'll refer you back to the SGEM podcast because they did another wonderful review on this paper. All right, another common myth. Your fever is going up and it has to be treated.
Yeah, there's a sense that, oh my God, the temperature's been going up a degree an hour. The parents are checking the temperature every 14 minutes and it's still going up. But there's a ceiling. It's not going to generally go above 104 because your hypothalamus is taking care of it. It's a regulated physiologic response and it's not going to go much higher. So the fact that it's climbing doesn't mean it's going to climb to infinity. It will have its natural stopping.
And again, this all refers back to the hypothalamus. And you can see temperatures of 105, 106. That's basically the 40.6 to 41.1 roughly degree Celsius part. And these are what we actually recall as high fever. So when people talk about high fever of 102, that's not a high fever. But when we are talking about getting this 105, 106 range, that's a true high fever. That actually meets the technical definition of it. And once we get over that 106 mark, that's when we start getting some weird stuff going on. Maybe our hypothalamus isn't actually regulating things. We need to look at other potential causes for why this is going on. But that 105, 106 can still be pretty scary at times. But again, we need to look at how the patient's doing and try and correlate. It's worth noting, too, that peripheral temperatures really suck at getting good numbers. So if you're seeing higher numbers, get a core body temperature again.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, those numbers, like you said, they're not going to cause damage necessarily, but they have been shown the quote unquote high fever, the 105, 106, have been shown to correlate with kind of worse badness. So that's something to keep in mind. But again, it's not causing damage in and of itself.
And we call this SBI, or serious bacterial infections. You'll see this in a lot of papers when they start referring to these high numbers about the incidence of SBI. And it is very, very important to note that SBI can happen in even normothermia. So meningitis is like, and sepsis are probably the two most common ones we're talking about there. So just because the patient has a really high temperature, yeah, this should raise your suspicion for, is there SBI going on? Is there a serious bacterial infection? But we shouldn't rule it out because they don't have a high fever. So again, just keep in mind that this is something to at least think about. This is what some of the literature points to. A lot of this is pre-vaccination era, but even post-vaccination, there's some weaker evidence pointing to the same.
Right. I mean, you can't really hang your hat on high fever or normothermia to tell you what's going on any more than you can hang your hat on, you know, the white count being elevated or normal. Well, nothing bad's going on because the white count's normal, and oh, something terrible is going on because the white count is elevated. One of my favorite quotes from Amelman, too, I don't know if you've heard it, is that the white count is the last refuge of the intellectually destitute. And I think of that every time, like, somebody asks me, well, what's the white count? Well, what does it matter? But the fever is kind of the same thing. It's like, just because the fever is normal and the person looks sick, you have to kind of keep that in mind.
The most common person you ask me the white count is the surgeon.
With a flaming appy. No, let's just leave that appy in there because it's got a white count of 8. So nothing to do here.
It's distended. It's got an epidecolith. It looks like it's ready to bust any second. Well, it's a normal white count. It's fine, guys.
Yeah, we're all good.
All right, moving on to the next thing. This is actually kind of one of my favorites to educate people on, because parents come in all the time. I'm sure they do the same thing in Down East Maine, where they come in and little Johnny, he always used Johnny, I don't know why, but little Johnny comes in. They've been treating the fever at home, but it will not go down to a quote unquote normal temperature with the medicine they've been giving.
Yeah. And trying to reassure them that that's okay is kind of challenging. I mean, treatment is only going to bring the temp down by a couple degrees. And sometimes it's because they've been underdosing. But again, it's okay. Doesn't mean that there's badness going on just because you can't get them down to a normal temperature. You know, you could throw some of these kids, you could throw everything in the book at them, and they're only going to bring their temp down just a little bit. And that's okay.
I actually had an adult patient the other day with mono who came back in the second time because she couldn't bring her fever down at home and was worried that, you know, if I can't take care of this fever at home, what am I supposed to do? And she took, now given adult patient, so she took the lowest doses of Tylenol and ibuprofen, acetaminophen over the counter. And so that was like the 200 milligrams of the 325. And her temperature went down by about 2 degrees still. And once we gave her a more appropriate dose for her age, it went down the rest of the way. And I kind of talked about proper dosing, and I explained to her at the very beginning that this may be all the temperature decrease we see, but it's possible you can have a little more of a drop. And she felt great afterwards and was kind of a little bit embarrassed, but I told her there's no reason to be embarrassed with it. But I do with the same thing with parents, is that they may be giving as little as to a quarter or half the dose. They may be following what's on the little thing on the back of the box telling them how much to use, but that may not be enough for their kid. And so I go over proper dosing, and there's, again, some studies showing that if you use the proper dosing, weight-based dosing, you'll actually get a pretty good effect. And for acetaminophen, that's 15 milligrams per kilogram. For ibuprofen, that's 10 milligrams per kilogram. And that seems to help just that much more. But realistically, I warn parents that temperatures won't go back down to normal a lot of times. If they're higher temps to start with, if say it was 104 or 40 degrees Celsius, you may only bring it down by 1 or 2 degrees Celsius. So expect there to still be an elevated temperature when it's all said and done.
Right. And reassuring parents of that while you're in the emergency department can really save them a lot of angst and maybe save them another potential visit to the ED when they can't get that fever down.
So here's another one. I don't see as much in my area. I don't know if it's just because of education of parents or how that works, but some will only believe that you can use only ibuprofen or acetaminophen. You can't use both to treat for the fever and pain.
And our population has actually gotten pretty savvy about this and actually will either do a combined or an alternating therapy. And that has been shown to be more effective in bringing the temperature down and having the temperature stay down longer. But in looking at that, it's kind of on the fence as to whether or not there's actual improvement in the child's discomfort by bringing these numbers down. So it's kind of iffy to say, well, if you want to see if your kid will be more comfortable by either combining or alternating the Tylenol and ibuprofen, then that's a reasonable thing to do. But anytime you're combining medicines in one way or another, there's always some worry about dosing confusion, and there's an increase in adverse effects when you're talking about adding another medicine to the mix. So that's something you have to really be pretty vigilant about educating the parents on what is the right dose they should be giving and when, if they're going to be combining the treatment.
And there doesn't appear to be any strong evidence about alternating versus combined dosing. But for me, and I even do this because, you know, I've got other people who are helping take care of my kid, and I'm always worried that one of us is going to screw something up. So I combine doses.
Yeah, that's what I recommend as well, just because for confusion's sake. I mean, if you're thinking, well, what was the last dose that I gave? Was that Tylenol? Was it ibuprofen? What time did I give it? I just say 4 times a day, combined Tylenol and ibuprofen.
Exactly. You can stick every 6 hours and you're good to go. You know, just acetaminophen, ibuprofen together, especially if you can give it as one little concoction. Like, you can usually get the grape in both. And so I'll give them both. Like, I measure them out, then combine them, and then give them to the kid. And usually that works out really, really well. And then there's a lot less guesswork. But some people are just stuck with alternating, and that's okay. I just make sure that A, we give them a dosing sheet. And I try and do that all the time anyway. But A, we give them a dosing sheet, and then B, really have them write down somewhere what was the last dose they gave of what. That's the next best thing if they don't want to actually do the combined dosing.
I agree.
All right, let's go to the next myth. So an exact temperature is important. I have to know that it was 103.6.
Yeah, that's really not all that relevant. The absolute temperature, like we were talking about earlier, doesn't really correlate clinically to what's going on. And you have to look at the patient. Does the kid look good? Does the kid look sick? And the appearance and condition is much more important than the absolute number that you get.
And this kind of goes into our next one. I know we've already talked about this to a degree, but it's still worth mentioning on its own. The fever's high, so it must be bad.
Yeah. Well, like we talked about, a high temp doesn't necessarily mean badness, and normal temperature doesn't necessarily mean that there's nothing going on. Doesn't really tell you how severe. You can see high temps with a viral etiology. Doesn't help you really differentiate between viral or bacterial. So you can't really distinguish badness with this any more than you can with the white count, like we talked about before.
That's something I see a lot with parents when they come in and they say, well, their temperature is 104, so 40 degrees Celsius. Well, it has to be bacterial. No, I've seen plenty of viral illnesses, especially influenza, where...
Yeah, I was just going to say, we saw a lot of high temps this round. I don't know if you've been your way out west where you are, but...
Oh my gosh, yes.
Lots of high temps, yeah.
Yeah, all the time. Parents are coming in all the time for this temperature. And you see these adult patients. And actually, I worry more about adult patients when their temperature gets that high. And then we flu swab them. And then we do some other routine testing just to make sure we're not missing, for example, the superimposed pneumonia or whatever have you. And find out that, nope, just influenza. You just got a bad case of it. You know, you give them some fluids. You give them some medicine. They feel so much better and they're ready to be discharged. And obviously, we're not talking about Tamiflu because that'd be a whole separate discussion. Maybe,
no.
maybe we need to have our own separate thing on that. Asl Tamivir is the right? That I always screw up how to say that, but that's the generic name for anyone who's listening and doesn't know what Tamiflu is, if you've somehow avoided that whole sensationalism, we'll call it.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you haven't watched the news for the past 6 months.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so we're getting close to the end of our myth section here. Oh my gosh. Michelle, I'm sure you see this all the time too. We can't break the fever. It has to be bad.
Right. I've been waking Johnny up. That poor Johnny gets sick all the time. I've been waking Johnny up in the night to give him ibuprofen. I've been giving it to him all through the day, and that fever just will not break. Hear that all the time. But that doesn't, again, it's not an indicator of badness. It happens with viruses. It happens with bacteria. It can happen with a bad illness or a not so bad illness. So whether or not the fever response to medication does not indicate the severity of the illness that's underlying it.
And it's worth noting that this goes back to a couple different points. So again, how much the temperature can be dropped by with the medicine, that plays a huge role. That also plays a role in what the kid's doing. So if they're running around a lot and still playing and active, their temperature's probably not going to go all the way back down. That's just because of normal activity along with the infection. So there's just so many different factors. Again, it's not enough. You got to look at the kid. In fact, I feel like almost every answer is, what does the actual kid look like, or the adult, or whoever you're dealing with? What does the actual patient look like? And that makes a big difference there.
Absolutely.
And then this one, I don't see a lot of, maybe you see it, but it was something I saw in a couple of different places. I'm like, I guess people really believe this. And that is, we brought the fever down, so now it should stay down.
Right. That fever keeps coming back. I don't see that as much as I do the, I can't break the fever thing, but there's this assumption that once the fever breaks, whether or not it's been because of antipyretics or because the virus is simply running its course, kind of there's this feeling that if the fever's down once, you're done with it. But that's not necessarily the case. And the fever can last for days with some of these illnesses. And so, again, that's where education comes in, because a lot of times I'll have people come in, they've seen their pediatrician 3 or 4 days before, and they were told, if the fever's not gone in 3 days, then they need to come to the emergency department and be checked out. And I try to educate that, no, this is something that can be more of a prolonged process. These viruses don't get out of your system that quickly sometimes. And as long as your body's fighting the virus, you're going to be having the fever. And that can be several days.
And especially with influenza and some of these other kind of more serious viral infections, you can see this. You can see fever for a week or so. So again, this is not something that's going to be fixed with one dose of acetaminophen.
Absolutely.
All right, so we've gone through the myths. We've done our disclaimers right at the beginning. We've also talked about some of the ways we treat temperatures and why we're treating the temperature. But Michelle, I mean, we've talked about so much, and we could probably talk forever about this subject. I'm surprised we've actually gotten through the material this quickly. But do you have any other thoughts?
I know. I think it's sometimes we're in the emergency department presented with what it seems like a Sisyphean task to really try to debunk some of this stuff with parents, and they look at you like you're a moron because they've been told all, you know, they're basically, it's been pounded into them that fever is dangerous. Don't let your kid have a fever. And so it sometimes feels like we're really rolling that rock uphill, but I think we can make a difference if we keep just educating and letting people know why we're telling them the things that we're telling them. So we can make a difference in this, but it seems like a real uphill battle sometimes.
And I think we talked a little bit about this off air, and we didn't really mention it at the beginning, but part of the reason why I wanted to have this discussion is because it seems like so much in medicine and to the lay public and everyone else is that, I don't know what it is. It maybe is an evolutionary mechanism or something, but your kid has a cough. Your kid has a cough. Your kid has a runny nose. Your kid has a runny nose. You know, a little bit of sore throat. Whatever. As soon as they get that fever, oh my God, things are going to be bad and we have to be checked out. I don't know what it is that has trained us that fever is the thing to worry about versus my kid looks kind of crappy. There probably is something wrong.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that we as clinicians really kind of fed on this because the teaching was earlier on that a fever did mean badness. So, you know, there was a lot more credence lent to illnesses where there was a fever. And so it was kind of perpetuated, I think, throughout our community and passed down. I mean, generation to generation, as it were, with families. Like, you'll see a lot now. I mean, I think it's a lot of times the grandmothers are more worried about the kids than the parents are, just because it was always drilled into their head. If your kid has a fever, your kid is really sick and needs to go to the doctor, go to the hospital.
Actually, I'm glad you mentioned the grandma a bit, because I think about the same thing with the grandmother who's basically the mindset is, and this isn't meant to be offensive in any way, shape, or form, but, you know, grandma's worried about her grandbaby because they have a fever. And then she remembers that when she was little, you know, her grandma died of a fever. And right. We're talking about so many generations back that, yeah, fever may have been the only symptom because we didn't really know how to check for everything else. Yeah, grandma actually probably had sepsis secondary to pneumonia or UTI or whatever, but there wasn't really a way to diagnose that per se, or at least not diagnose it well. And grandma lived 100 miles from any actual place with a doctor. So grandma had a fever and died.
Right, right.
So yeah, I think these are all important points. And then the last thing I really want to mention is that obviously this is a controversial subject. There are going to be people who look at this title who don't actually probably listen to the podcast, even though we have all the pearls with it. They're going to look at a couple of things and say, these people are freaking idiots. They don't know what they're talking about, and ignore the evidence base and everything else and just say that, no, you have to worry about the fever. And again, we've given our caveats. We've already explained there are exceptions to these myths and rules and stuff like that. But I think it's worth mentioning to parents when I do this education that different people are going to have different thoughts about this. No one's necessarily right or wrong, but it's just worth understanding what the actual evidence is and how we apply it to your child in that specific incidence. Because again, that's the ultimate goal of evidence-based medicine, is you're taking everything in together and then applying it to that patient in front of you.
Right. It's always a challenge when, especially like the instances that I was mentioning before, when the PCP is the one who sent them in or gave them these guidelines that are not evidence-based. For example, keeping the kiddo, you know, normothermic when they have an illness so they don't have a seizure. So what I'm trying to do the education there, I mean, obviously you don't want to drive a wedge between the parents and their primary care provider. You want to present things in a very respectful way. Like, I understand why you were told this, but the evidence that we're looking at now is that it really doesn't do any good to do this, or this is really not the best path to take. It's sort of like, you know, definitely don't put down the other clinician, but it's a good educational opportunity. And if you just tell them why, I think it really makes a big difference.
And on that happy note, I think we've hit all the big stuff. So do you have anything else, Michelle?
No, I think it was a great topic to cover. You picked out some great papers.
Oh, well, thank you. So without further ado, Michelle, can you give us the tagline?
Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.